I think God, in His marvelous wisdom, finds us spots and niches in life that we would never have dreamed of, but He's placed us like a grain of salt to penetrate the insipid surroundings in which we live. And if you keep salt in a salt shaker, it's no good. When you put it into the soup, even though the soup dissolves it, the soup never tastes the same again.
If you suddenly found yourself before an audience of important government leaders, how would you communicate with them? How do you think they would respond to you? Where does the message of the Bible fit in with government and citizenship? Hello and welcome to Let My People Think, the weekly program featuring apologist Ravi Zacharias. We're glad you're with us today for the first part of Ravi's message, Bridging Two Worlds. Now, many times the Apostle Paul found himself before men of great influence, and the way that he communicated with them was absolutely marvelous. Today we'll look at one incident found in Acts chapter 24, in which Paul interacts with the Roman leader Felix. As Ravi describes it, Paul's method was brilliant. For followers of Christ, there are some valuable lessons to be learned about reaching the world around us, whether we're communicating with people in government, like Paul was, or whether we're trying to reach the person next door, or our own family members. Now, here's Ravi with his message, Bridging Two Worlds.
How can you and I, in a nation that seems to be hanging in the middle, choosing between the possibility of faith and spirituality and moving over rather to the side of skepticism, what role do you and I have? It is fascinating, as I cannot help but comment on it, when you see political platforms established where morality is completely jettisoned and freedom takes priority over right and wrong, and the only moral right left in this world, in our world anyway, is the moral right of freedom, which is an illusion. There is no such thing as absolute freedom. It's a contradiction in terms, just as there is no such thing as free love. It is the nature of love to bind itself. And when a man and woman stand in front of an altar, the average woman just pays the man the compliment of taking him at his word. I do. But we try to believe that as a nation, somehow America is going to prove what other nations have not succeeded in proving. And it was Santayana who said, "He who refuses to learn from history is forced to repeat its mistakes." He who refuses to learn from history is forced to repeat its mistakes. Now, on the one side of it, you and I have a dream. We would love to see this nation, in a sense, so totally and wholly monolithic in its expression, in its religious commitment to Jesus Christ. But as a pluralistic nation, that's an idealistic dream, which you and I know realistically can never unfold, certainly not by enforced legislation. We are not an Islamic country which compels people to bend the knee. But in our hearts and minds is what William Blake would have said about England when he uttered those words, "And did those feet in ancient times walk upon England's mountains green, when was the holy Lamb of God on England's pleasant pasture seen? I shall not cease from mental flight, nor shall my sword sleep in my hand, till we have seen Jerusalem built on England's green and pleasant pasture lands." And that, by the way, was the hymn with which the film Chariots of Fire had been introduced, the choir singing the words of William Blake, "And did those feet in ancient times walk upon England's mountains green." But it wasn't long after that where Wordsworth was saying, "Milton, thou shouldest be living at this hour, England hath need of thee." So we have that dream, and yet we have that prayer. And I would like you to turn with me, please, to your Bibles, to Acts chapter 24, as we see this tremendous bridging of two worlds, an ambassador for Christ before a member of the royalty representing the greatest empire that ever existed, the great Roman Empire. And here stands this ambassador in the person of the Apostle Paul, standing before Felix, and then is going to go on after that to talk before Festus and Agrippa and so on. A powerful sequence of messages by this man who described himself as abnormally born, wrenched from the womb in that conversion experience. Acts chapter 24, and may I read from verse 10, verses 1 to 9, the Roman prosecutor, the lawyer Tertullus, has just presented his case against Paul. Paul has not brought his defense attorney with him, he's going to defend himself, and he begins here with verse 10. And I like to read the chapter in its entirety because it is important. "When the governor motioned for him to speak, Paul replied, 'I know that for a number of years you have been a judge over the nation, so I gladly make my defense. You can easily verify that no more than 12 days ago I went up to Jerusalem to worship. Now here he's going to deal with the single accusations that are made against him, one after another. My accusers did not find me arguing with anyone at the temple, or stirring up a crowd in the synagogues or anywhere else in the city, and they cannot prove to you the charges they are now making against me. However, I admit that I worship the God of our fathers as a follower of the way, which they call a sect. I believe everything that agrees with the law and that is written in the prophets. And I have the same hope in God as these men, that there will be a resurrection of both the righteous and the wicked. So I strive always to keep my conscience clear before God and man. After an absence of several years, I came to Jerusalem to bring my people gifts for the poor and to present offerings. I was ceremonially clean when they found me in the temple courts doing this. There was no crowd with me, nor was I involved in any disturbance. But there are some Jews from the province of Asia who ought to be here before you and bring charges if they have anything against me. Or these who are here should state what crime they found in me when I stood before the Sanhedrin. Unless it was this one thing that I shouted as I stood in their presence, it is concerning the resurrection of the dead that I am on trial before you today. Then Felix, who was well acquainted with the way, adjourned the proceedings. When Lysias the commander comes, he said, I will decide your case. He ordered the centurion to keep Paul under guard, but to give him some freedom and permit his friends to take care of his needs. Several days later, Felix came with his wife Drusilla, who was a Jewess. He sent for Paul and listened to him as he spoke about faith in Christ Jesus. As Paul discoursed, please listen now, on righteousness, self-control, and the judgment to come, Felix was afraid and said, that's enough for now. You may leave. When I find it convenient, I will send for you. At the same time, he was hoping that Paul would offer him a bribe, so he sent for him frequently and talked with him. It is an incredibly intriguing passage, almost self-explanatory, and I will do my best not to damage the clarity of the passage before you. I want you to imagine this scene. Paul, right from the beginning of his conversion, had been anointed, almost dragged out of the womb, he says. I did not want this position. Now, every other disciple of Christ came to know the Lord in a sequence of his birth, life, death, and resurrection. Of his birth, life, death, and resurrection. Not only a logical sequence, but a chronological sequence, and it made sense. When the early disciples started to follow him, the first question they posed to him was, where do you live? Is this not Joseph's son? Was not his father a carpenter? Is not Mary his mother? Are not his brothers and sisters still with us today? They wanted to know where Jesus' roots were. So they go right back to the home and then follow his life, see the messages or hear the messages, see the miracles, finally go with him to the cross, see the extinction of their dreams until he rises from the dead, and then all of that previous part becomes explainable. Paul has a unique entrance into Christ. As far as we know, he did not follow that track. He came to Christ in reverse sequence. He knew him following the resurrection and then traced back through the cross to the rest of his life. That's why I think he always puts it in that sequence, that I may know him, the power of his resurrection and the fellowship of his suffering being made conformed unto his death. Most others went through the conformity of suffering and then the power of the resurrection, as Peter and all had experienced in their encounter with Christ. So for Paul, the linchpin of his argument, the peg on which he hangs his entire apologetic, is the resurrection. And so he so clearly says, if Christ be not raised from the dead, we are of all men to be our most miserable and to be pitied. When I listen to some of our political ideologues today, and even politicians, there is something within me that cries out and says, dear God, where are the statesmen when this world desperately needs one? Who are these people who make such pronouncements, hardly worthy of statesmanship, who seem to gain their strength from condemning the other one? I could not but recall what Billy Graham once told us. He said he was in a room with Chancellor Konrad Adenauer, probably one of the greatest statesmen of the 20th century. He had to pick up the pieces of a broken Germany on the heels of Hitler, the mayor of Cologne. And Billy Graham was a young evangelist. And Konrad Adenauer sent for Billy Graham and called him into his chambers. And Billy Graham said this, I sat there nervously sitting in this very prestigious office, knowing I was in the presence of a giant amongst men, politically, and very astute. And then, add in our surprise, the young evangelist, he looked at him and said, "Mr. Graham, do you believe in the resurrection of Jesus Christ?" And Billy Graham was stunned for a moment. And he said, "Sir, if I did not believe in the resurrection of Jesus Christ, I would not be an evangelist." And then Billy Graham says this, "Conrad Adenauer walked over to his window, looked through that window there at the debris in Cologne and all that the war had wrecked, and he turned towards Billy Graham, and this great statesman said this, and our modern day politicians need to hear it. He said this, 'Mr. Graham, outside of the resurrection of Jesus Christ, I know of no other hope for mankind.'" What an incisive comment. "Outside of the resurrection of Jesus Christ, I know of no other hope for mankind." Now I know our scholars in the universities try to make mincemeat out of this dogma, but that same risen Christ is someday going to confound their petty arguments, for he has conquered the greatest enemy, death itself, which stalks every one of us. So here comes Paul, and I want you to picture the scene. One writer describes it in these words: "What a contrast. On the throne sat Felix, the faded and withered pagan, a former slave. He became a favorite of Claudius, and by that emperor was exalted to high rank. Greed, cruelty, and lust were stamped upon his countenance. His administration as procurator of Judea had been marked by injustice, extortion, and violence. By his side sat the lovely Jewess Drusilla, a daughter of Herod Agrippa. She had first married a Gentile, who to please her had become a Jew. But then Felix, with the aid of a sorcerer's incantations, had won her from her husband and was living with her in sin and shame. All that was dishonorable in mankind was represented by that combination of Felix and Drusilla as they sat on the throne and as they were awaiting the address by St. Paul. Before them, with chains on his arms and his body scarred with the marks of his suffering for Christ's sake, and his coarse garment, which his own hands had woven and contrasted with the velvet and purple of Felix and his paramour, stood this lonely ambassador for Christ." How ironic it is, time and time again, you see God as the God of contrasts. You see God as the God of contrasts. You look at Luke chapter 3. In the 15th year of Tiberius Caesar, Pontius Pilate being governor of Judea, Herod being tetrarch of Galilee, Philip being tetrarch of Iturea and Trachonitis, Lysanias being tetrarch of Abilene, Annas and Caiaphas being the high priest, the word of the Lord came to John in the wilderness. How do you like that? You've got seven heroes cluttering the historical landscape, and you've got a funny man wearing funny clothes, eating funny food, who's going to stand before them, to whom the word of the Lord came. What a contrast. The Roman emperor's representative with Drusilla, who, by the way, if my studies are right, I don't think she was 20 years old at this point. She was betrothed at the age of 16 and through some machinations had been pulled away, then one marriage, and then through the sorcerer's incantations had been drawn away. So here she was, barely out of her teens, sitting and listening to Paul. And it was her insistence that Paul was being brought back by Felix to hear him. There it is, and you see now what is beginning to take place. I'm an apologist. By that I mean a defender of the Christian faith amongst contrary worldviews and rather antagonistic settings. I want you to know I would have probably trembled to the very marrow of my bones in front of a setting like this. I don't know if you've ever been in such intimidating settings. I was once speaking to a totally Hindu and Muslim audience. My wife was present in there, in that audience in India. One wrong word and you were going to be lynched. I'll never forget when I was trying to take a drink of water in that debate, picking my cup up. I couldn't hold the cup. My hand was just trembling like that. Just fear taking over. And here he stands. What has he got before him? He's got to bring four worldviews into focus and then show you which one is right. Because naturally, Felix was going to represent the Roman worldview. Paul himself had come studying from a Greek university in Tarsus. The university in Greek in Tarsus was even greater than the University of Athens. He was raised at the feet of Gamaliel. He was well versed with the Jewish worldview. But now he was coming with the message of Christ. So here's the Roman world, here's the Greek world, here's the Jewish world, here's the Christian concept, and he is going to come with his message. I want you to notice the similarity between his struggle and the similarity between ours, just in case we think his was easier. Alfred Edersheim, in his book, The Life and Times of Jesus the Messiah, describes Rome of that day. "Religion, philosophy, and society had passed through every stage to that of despair. Without tracing the various phases of ancient thought, it may be generally said that in Rome, at least, the issue lay between Stoicism and Epicureanism. The one flattered its pride, the other gratified its sensuality. The one was in accordance with the original national character, the other with its latter decay and corruption. Both ultimately led to atheism and despair. The one by turning all higher aspirations selfward, the other by quenching them in the enjoyment of the moment. The one by making the extinction of all feeling and self-deification, the other the indulgence of every passion and the worship of matter, its ideal. Now listen to this. It would be unsavory to describe how far the worship of indecency was carried in Rome, how public morals were corrupted by the mimic representations of everything that was vile, and even by the pandering of a corrupt art, the personation of gods, oracles, divinations, dreams, astrology, all contributed to the general decay. It has been rightly said that the ideas of conscience, as we understand it, were destroyed by heathenism. Absolute right did not exist. Might was right. The social relations exhibited, if possible, even deeper corruption. The sanctity of marriage had ceased. Female dissipation and the general dissoluteness led at last to an almost entire cessation of marriage. Abortion and the exposure of murder and of newly born children were common and tolerated. Unnatural vices, which even the greatest philosophers practice, if not advocated, attained proportions which defy description. Edersheim wrote decades ago. He's telling you what Rome was like. And if abortion and perversion, sensuality and sexuality was rife in that time, there stood this ambassador for Christ. And you and I stand today. Look at a modern day journalist describing our time. Steve Turner, the English journalist, who does a masterful job of sarcastically describing our day. And you can see Rome all over again. You love this. Listen to it. He says, "We believe in Marx, Freud and Darwin. We believe everything is okay. As long as you don't hurt anyone, to the best of your definition of hurt, and to the best of your definition of knowledge. We believe in sex before, during, and after marriage. We believe in the therapy of sin. We believe that adultery is fun. We believe that sodomy is okay. We believe that taboos are taboo. We believe that everything's getting better despite evidence to the contrary. The evidence must be investigated, and you can prove anything with evidence. We believe there's something in horoscopes, UFOs, and bent spoons. Jesus was a good man, just like Buddha, Muhammad, and ourselves. He was a good moral teacher, although we think his good morals were really bad. We believe that all religions are basically the same. At least the one that we read was. They all believe in love and goodness. They only differ on matters of creation, sin, heaven, hell, God, and salvation. We believe that after death comes the nothing, because when you ask the dead what happens, they say nothing. If death is not the end, and if the dead have lied, then it's compulsory heaven for all, excepting perhaps Hitler, Stalin, and Genghis Khan. We believe in Masters and Johnson. What's selected is average, what's average is normal, what's normal is good. We believe in total disarmament. We believe there are direct links between warfare and bloodshed. We believe that man is essentially good. It's only his behavior that lets him down. This is the fault of society. Society is the fault of conditions. Conditions are the fault of society. We believe that each man must find the truth that is right for him, and reality will adapt accordingly. The universe will readjust, history will alter. We believe that there is no absolute truth, except the truth that there is no absolute truth. We believe in the rejection of creeds and the flowering of individual thought." And then he adds this postscript, "If chance be the father of all flesh, disaster is his rainbow in the sky. And when you hear state of emergency, sniper kills 10, troops on rampage, youths go looting, bomb blast school, it is but the sound of man worshipping his maker." So you and I may boast today of the greatest nation on earth. And I have to wonder if that would be God's estimate. I don't know. We have certainly become the most violent nation on earth, so that our young people cannot even go to schools without fear, or our teachers without fear of being attacked. We had to pull our daughter out of a school in Atlanta where she was going because her classmate was so brutally attacked till her nose was smashed, her cheekbone was broken, and she was in intensive care for days. Why? Because when backing up from her locker, she bumped into another young boy who was holding a glass of his chocolate milk in his hand, and it spilled his chocolate milk. He picked her up, smashed her to the ground, and smashed her face, broke her nose, fractured the bone above the eye too. She was lying in a hospital. The sound of man worshiping his maker. What Rome signified then, we signify now. I look at Paul, and I can only look at him briefly. I give you three lessons I learned from him. And what I want you to notice in how Paul approached this in his methodological genius and his theological maturity. His methodological genius and his theological maturity. First, look at the methodological genius. You see, he starts off with a point of reference. He tries to establish a framework within which he and the king could be talking on common terms. So often when we talk to people, we have no common point of reference. And so the first thing Paul talks about is a framework of righteousness. He talks about a framework of righteousness so that when he says good and bad, his listener will know exactly what he means. Today, if you try to establish a contact with anybody at random and use the terms good and bad, you know as well as I know, we're not talking about the same thing because they don't mean the same thing to everybody. Morals has become the most fluid term in our culture. Bertrand Russell, in his famous debate with the Jesuit priest Copleston, when Bertrand Russell was asked how he differentiated between good and bad, Russell says the same way I differentiate between blue and green. To which Copleston said, but you differentiate between blue and green by seeing, don't you? Russell says, yes. Then how do you differentiate between good and bad? Here's this brilliant Cambridge mathematician philosopher. His answer was on the basis of feeling. What else? Well, my question to Russell would have been, wait a minute, sir. In some cultures, they love their neighbors. In other cultures, they eat them, both on the basis of feeling. Do you have any personal preference? How do you establish a framework? There must be a common point of setting. Let me give you another illustration. Do you know how philosophy comes into your life and mine? It comes in at three levels. Level one, theory. Socrates, Plato, Aristotle. Most of us will never crack a book open on them because for whatever reason. Level one, theory. Level two is drama. Drama. When you watch a television program of any kind, today you can be sure it brings with it a philosophical worldview. Even when you're listening to the news, you're listening to a philosophy of life. So whether you watch the Archie Bunker or you watch any of the modern day shows, I really don't watch it. I've got so many better things to do. But whatever you watch, you're listening to a philosophy of life coming through. That's level two, the arts. Level three is when you're sitting around the kitchen table and your son says, Dad, today at school they were discussing sexual preferences. Why do you think one is right and the other is wrong? And the dad says, son, you better tell them what Romans 1 says. And the son probably gulps for the moment and says, Dad, if you don't mind my saying so, Romans 1 works around this table. It doesn't work in the classroom. Level 1 is theory. Level 2 is drama. Level 3 is kitchen table conversation. Listen to the modern day talk show hosts. They fulfill what Paul says, forever speaking, understanding nothing. But you've got three levels. Listen now. You must always argue from level one, illustrate from level two, and apply at level three. Always argue from level one, illustrate from level two, apply from level three. Level one and two are completely thrown out. Level three is your preference versus my preference, and it's one like versus another like, one feeling versus another feeling. Have you ever heard a talk show host defend why anything should be right or anything should be wrong other than that he thinks so? Logic is gone.
And we'll stop there for today. Well, all of us have areas of influence, relationships in which we can make a difference. When the time comes to discuss the gospel and the message of Christ, where do we begin? Well, Ravi challenged us to begin as the Apostle Paul did with Felix. Paul found a common point of reference and started there, creating a framework in which both he and Felix could relate. For Paul, that point of reference was the quest for virtue and righteousness. In your relationships, it could be something different, such as the desire for security or the hunger for meaning. Whatever it is, find a point of reference and start there, and then watch as God moves in the lives of others. Today's broadcast is available as part of a 3-CD album. When ordering, ask for CD 304, titled Leadership and the Political Arena. Again, that's CD 304, titled Leadership and the Political Arena. If you'd like to place a credit card order, call us at 1-800-448-6766. Again, that's 1-800-448-6766. The order line is available 24 hours a day. If you prefer using the internet, go to rzim.org. That's rzim.org. Our online resource center is an interactive, user-friendly way to preview and order products. In addition, you'll find information about Ravi's ministry, essays and articles, and archived files of the Let My People Think broadcasts. Once again, the website is rzim.org. If you'd like to write, address your envelope to RZIM, Post Office Box 921-939, Norcross, Georgia, 30010. In Canada, write to 50 Gervais Drive, Suite 315, Toronto, Ontario, M3C1Z3. The Canadian address once again is 50 Gervais Drive, Suite 315, Toronto, Ontario, M3C1Z3. Please be sure to give us the call letters of this station when you contact us. Knowing which station you're listening to can help us better evaluate the effectiveness of the broadcast. This weekly program, Let My People Think, is a listener-supported radio ministry and a production of Ravi Zacharias International Ministries, Atlanta, Georgia.